very warm welcome to today's CBI at 10. There's a lot to get through today. We're talking about shortages of supply, shortages of labour, shortages of energy, and the sort of composite impact that all of that is having on our ambition to go for growth in 2022. I'm going to start with Matthew before we get into the meat and potatoes of today's conversation. There's some announcements coming this afternoon as it relates to COVID. Did you just give us a sort of heads up on what we might expect?
The COVID story is never far away from us on these webinar series. So look, on the back of some good news, I think, last week around the reduction from 7 to 5 days on self-isolation and easing of international travel restrictions, the good news is it feels like that cases are continuing to fall and therefore the optimism that the restrictions can ease is on the up. People will have been reading in the news, I'm sure, about the likelihood of the so-called Plan B restrictions coming to an end, particularly around the sort of work from home mandate, COVID secure passporting and so on. That feels consistent with some of the conversations we've been having with government. So watch this space, but we understand that announcements may come as soon as Wednesday afternoon, and then we'll be expecting clarity about what happens from the 26th of January onwards. I think, Liz, from a CBI perspective, look, the easing of those restrictions, particularly the working from home mandate, should be good news. It's better for business, and it's certainly good for those who are reliant on footfall in city centres and town centres and so on. But we're really keen, actually, that we make sure some of that basic infrastructure around masks, ongoing access to free testing and so on continues, so we don't end up in this situation as we have in the past, where we're having to lurch from sort of restrictions tightening if the situation worsens and then eases again. But if we can get to this steady state and using some of those COVID secure tools, that feels like a good way through to us. But watch this space. We're expecting some encouraging news imminently.
Thanks ever so much, Matthew. That's good to hear. And yeah, certainly don't want to get into a situation where we suddenly lurch back to these horrible absences that have been sort of crippling us in terms of short term. We're not here to talk about short term shortages. We're here to talk about the more structural stuff. And it's a very different set of prescription actions that business leaders in particular need to be taking, and indeed the resources that the CBI are making available to members to help see their way through. As I said, there's sort of three evil triplets to this, if you like: labour market, supply chain and energy. I'm tempted to start with supply chain if we can. I'm going to come to Jenny Beckwith in a second. We'll do labour. But let's start with the supply chain stuff. Matthew, just give us a sense of how these three factors are affecting one another, and then let's pick away at supply chain to begin with, and I'll come to Richard.
Totally right. I mean, that is how we're sort of bucketing the issues up in some way. And you're right, they're completely interconnected. But Jenny will touch more on labour shortages. But I think the sort of the 30-second version of that is it's happening at multiple levels in multiple sectors and multiple parts of the country. And its impact is sort of firstly holding down, artificially almost holding down the capacity in firms, so they're unable to benefit from the sort of full upswings in demand when it comes. And also we're seeing a complete sort of war for talent going on, basically. So recruitment is really hard. Everyone's fishing in the same pool. That's pushing up salaries and so on. So it's making it tough. On supply chains, look, I mean, I think this has its origins in COVID, and it's been a symptom almost of the stop-start nature of the global economy over the last 2 years, which has kind of meant that production has been stop and start. It's meant that we've had activity sort of dislocated in different parts of the world. That's led to disruption and sort of shipping and things like that, which Richard is much more expert on and we'll talk about in a moment. And the sort of end result, I think, for firms is probably increased lead times in many cases. It's certainly unpredictable, so that's hard to give your customer a sort of precise target date for when you might be able to fulfill an order. It's also pushing up costs because, again, everyone wants the same stuff and things like that, and they all want it as soon as possible. So everyone's fighting over that as well. And then just to complete the picture, Liz, you mentioned the three, but the third one, of course, is energy crisis and prices, yeah, which is also front and center of the news. And the backstory here is clearly one, again, it's a global issue. Global wholesale gas prices are very high, but the UK in particular bears the brunt from that because we have a particular reliance on it, and certainly in our energy generation, our electricity generation mix, and so on. And it's everyone's hurting, actually. I mean, of course, the sort of consumer facing story is the one that dominates the news headlines, rightly so, because it's significantly adding to the sort of cost of living pinch. We think it'll probably take something in the order of about £20 billion out of consumer spending, so it harms the economy and probably pushes up inflation by 1 or 2% when the price cap is, if as expected, goes up later this year. So it's hurting consumers, but it's also hurting businesses too. It adds to the sort of cost pinch that's coming through from wages, from supply chain issues we've just been talking about, energy layered on top of that, particularly I think for some of the energy intensive sectors where other countries and other governments have stepped in with greater levels of support. So there's an international competitiveness issue for the UK. Right. And the final bit of that is just to say, look, energy suppliers themselves are not having it easy. It's sort of the effect of the price cap not keeping pace with global wholesale prices means that margins are very, very significantly squeezed at a time when we want really significant investment going in to the green agenda. And also when they're picking up customers from failed energy suppliers who are on much sort of cheaper deals and so on, the cost of acquisition and the cost of servicing those customers is also not a great good news story for them either. So it's hurting always round on the energy front. And then Liz, bringing all those issues together, I think what in a sense we've been dealing with for a prolonged period of time now is just all of those short-term urgent headaches layered one on top of one another. They impact in their own right, as I've just described, but it's also taking up a huge amount of bandwidth, resilience, emotional energy in firms to be grappling with all of these things. And it's crowding out the time and space for companies to be thinking about how do I get ahead of the long-term important trends coming down the track, such as net zero, such as automation, such as technology, such as a changing workforce and so on. So I think when you have the cocktail of issues coming together in the way that I've just described it, that is the sort of net result. It's crowding out a focus on the long term when we really want to be going for growth.
Yes, I mean, really complicated picture, Matthew. And thanks for the introduction and sort of getting a sense of how these things are working together. I know that the CBI are working very hard to put together some quite meaty resources to support members through, which we'll make sure are made available to the people who are watching live. And of course, if you're listening back, they are on the CBI website for you. And we'll talk about a bit about what's in those a little bit later on. I'm going to come now, if I can, to Richard Ballantyne, who is with us. You're the Chief Executive of the British Port Association. Hi, Richard. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Liz. Thanks very much for having me.
Richard, as the British Ports Association, what are the issues impacting your members? We talked a lot on CBI webinars and sort of towards the back end of last year about lorry drivers, but it's a wider issue than that. Just give us a sense from your perspective what's happening in supply.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, as I said, and thanks so much. And thanks also to the CBI team for all the lobbying and promotion and noise that generally you make on our behalf as one sector amongst many. I think the fundamental thing I'll start with, ports, like many other organisations on this call and other members of the CBI, we're employers as well. We employ collectively around 115,000 jobs across the UK. And that means that ports, like others, have been looking at ways to mitigate the impacts of COVID, to secure workplaces, to work up new arrangements and measures over the last 2 years. Which has flown by, I'm sure many of the participants will agree. But there's been a lot of hard work that's gone into that. So thanks to the CBI for all your support and help in signposting and also discussing some of these issues with government. More specifically on supply chain issues, with the topic of today's discussion, the ports, they do a lot of different types of things in the UK, from sort of servicing offshore oil production, and offshore renewable energy activities through to conventional bulk cargoes and right down to unitized cargoes, things like containers and roll-on, roll-off units coming through from places like Europe. And I guess the thing that's really caught the attention in the media has been containers. So this is around 15% of our activities in the UK. And containers is a very, by definition, a very global market. So we effectively import a lot of goods that are manufactured from places like Asia, China, etc. They come around on ships, takes around 35, 40 days to get to the UK, to get to Northern Europe. where we still have a very viable and valuable consumer market in the UK of getting on for 70 million people, as does the continent of Europe. And those goods come into some of our big container terminals. They go into big hubs in Europe as well, and some are fed across. And what we've seen post-lockdown is that, first of all, we had issues in China getting the goods out. Then our economies closed down because governments took the decision to restrict activity, to close shops, to close other non-essential activities, which led to a bit of a backlog and lots of queues of traffic in terms of, you know, storage, in terms of demand, in terms of warehousing. And that we haven't really got to grips with that fully. We're not in the worst situation in terms of the ports and supply chain and the shipping markets, but we are seeing issues where empty containers are being, you know, it's been difficult to get them back to Asia to be filled up and stocked. And all this is a set to a backdrop of increased shipping prices, where the shipping industry is rushing to make hay while the sun shines, so to speak, because they've been really squeezed since the last recession. But now prices are so high, they want to be delivering things. So they're rushing to get these full containers around the world. And effectively what it's done is led to a big load of backlogs in particularly Europe and North American ports and beyond. But we are just about getting to grips with that now. So the containers are getting back to Asia, they're being filled up. And it, of course, I think Matthew mentioned effectively a perfect storm. You have a few issues that couple on top of this or double up, things like labor shortages. And of course, haulage is the very, you know, well publicized issue. As we know, some of the reasons, there's an ongoing haulage shortage anyway in the UK. Our departure from the EU certainly exacerbated that challenge. And effectively what it's meant is that domestic drivers in the UK, there's less of them. So it means that goods that arrive into UK ports are generally taking longer to be collected and delivered to their end destinations. Now, you know, it's not a terminal issue. It's just adding extra costs, extra time to a process that's already been hit by, you know, those empty container issues and other factors. So we're getting there now. You know, of course, Brexit comes around the corner, the next stage of the transition, that hasn't exactly helped, but we appear to be managing. But the final sort of word I give to my introductory statement is that a lot of the deep sea carriers are saying that there could be some congestion, some issues with the supply chain for at least another year. So, you know, we're not through this yet.
Thanks ever so much, Richard. You preempted my question. I was going to say you painted a very clear picture of what caused the sort of bottleneck, the sort of traffic, as I imagine it, only in the sea, and how long it will take to sort of unwind some of that stuff. And I fully understand on the cost base, when you talk about shipping, that it's really the demand that is giving the sort of inflationary cost pressure on shipping. Do you think that will maintain on the cost of shipping, or do you think this is a sort of temporary thing that will then all settle down when everything starts to ease again?
I think there's evidence it has started to settle down somewhat, although I'm sure some of the CBI members who are importing goods may have some anecdotal examples of how their costs have stayed higher than before. But we are seeing certainly decreases and slight declines on the shipping costs that are a routine, you know, fixed costs and things that generally go up and down when contracts change, etc. Whereas if you just turn up in China, so to speak, and you want to get a container around, those, you know, spot rates, those sort of daily rates are still fairly high. But things have gone down, fortunately. But equally, you know, as I said before, if I'm an importer, a small business in the Midlands, wherever it may be, away from the shipping industry, I'm sure there are some sorry stories from those sectors about their costs being high.
Thanks ever so much, Richard. Is it a fair question at all? Because we've grappled with this a bit in conversations with CBI members over the last, 2 years, really. Do you have a sense of beyond the next 12 months, or are you really just sort of focusing on the immediate challenges and then we'll worry about 2023 when it comes? Do you have a sense of what might be further down the line?
Yeah, I think really long term, which isn't probably what you meant, but, you know, out for the next 30 years, we are seeing the expectation of unitized traffic. So that's containers and roll off units, vehicles, trailers, etc. We are predicting quite dramatic increases in that traffic, both globally and in the UK. And we're seeing port operators and shipping lines responding to those demands with long-term investments in new infrastructure, new equipment, etc. And more short-term, we are confident that things will settle down. Give us a bit of time to the maritime sector. We are confident things will settle down. But I think it's safe to say that the new norm is probably one that's a bit more sensitive to changes and dramatic changes. And, you know, we haven't really, I mentioned Brexit briefly, but we haven't really, broached that topic really, because about half our trade is with the European Union. And a lot of that is through unitized cargoes, particularly being driven either driver accompanied through the short straits or unaccompanied, which is effectively trailers that are dropped in European ports and then collected in UK ports after their seaward journey. And, you know, those pressures on new border controls, we've got customs at the moment, but the big thing for us will be the animal and plant health based products. So anything coming through, for example, tulips from the Netherlands that ends up in our supermarkets or florists here, all those will have to be checked in a range of different ports, not just those in the short straits. And that adds time, that adds costs, there'll be costs of inspections. And those kind of things, I think our logistics sector is just going to have to deal with for the next 12 months, have to take on the chin, unfortunately, because although the government has done a huge amount in its to mitigate some of the impacts, you cannot escape a lot of these kind of physical processes, which will definitely have a cost impact and a time impact as well.
Thanks ever so much. It's just completely fascinating. Just imagining that whole world is so alien to me. But I was delighted to see the tulips had arrived in Waitrose yesterday. It's the first sign of spring, so I was thrilled. Thanks ever so much, Richard. We'll come back to you. If you've got any questions for Richard, please do let us know. Jenny Beckwith, thanks very much for being here. You're the sort of employment guru at the CBI, and labour shortages is something we've discussed, as we said at the beginning, sort of acute challenges in labour, which largely relates to COVID, and then a much more structural long-term challenge that feels like a shift in the labour market that everybody is grappling with. And it doesn't just affect one sector or one type of worker, it's kind of throughout. So Jenny, just to open the bidding on this, because I think it's a really huge topic and very live, where are we now and how did we get here?
I think the short answer to that is just the real gap between the labour supply that the UK has and the demand for labour. And we had data out just yesterday saying that vacancies continue to be at a record high. We've had that for the last 5 months, vacancies over 1 million. And it really is a coalescence of factors. On the supply constraint side, the fundamental change is the introduction of the points-based immigration system that has changed the game in terms of that people can enter the UK. And of course, the legacy impacts of COVID, first accelerating the rate of EU nationals leaving the UK, but also having an effect on people staying in their jobs for the first year, then inevitably much more churn as people were wanting to move around and find alternatives, but also a longer term factor from COVID as well, where people are just reevaluating what they want from work, and it's caused a lot of people to take early retirement. So in total, we've had about 400,000 people of working age leave the UK labour market. We've had about 146,000 EU nationals leave, and that has put particular pressure on firms, as you say, across sectors. On the flip side, on the demand side, you know, part of this is what Richard was talking about as a huge reopening and strong customer demand. But I think the other thing that I would add is customer demand has also changed in how we're operating in a post-COVID world. So we are, you know, e-commerce and home deliveries, we're not going to move away from that. And that means even more demand for warehouse operatives and drivers, adding to additional pressures that the logistics sector is facing that Richard mentioned. Similarly, this change to remote and hybrid working, it means that IT professionals, cybersecurity professionals have never been in more demand. And those are just two examples of areas where we had existing skills gaps, people gaps before COVID. And then the way in which businesses are now operating, customer demand is operating, means that there is additional pressure on the demand side. And I think, what does all that mean? Well, the competition is fierce, as Matthew said. But I think the one additional thing that I would say that has really changed the game and is going to have to be a consideration for how firms respond in the future is, all of a sudden, particularly for businesses that have roles that can be done remotely or in a hybrid way, all of a sudden the competition isn't just from your local labour market, but potentially if you're a regional business, and I'm sure that there are many on the call now, facing pressures from competition in cities or the London waiting on terms and conditions and pay, for example.
Jenny, my first question, having heard about the early retirement factor, which of course is the dream, sadly not a present reality for me, do you think that the cost of living pinch, which is a very significant and real factor that hitting all of us in this country, do you think that might unwind or at least diffuse some of that as people find that they just can't afford to leave the labour market altogether in quite as short order as they thought they might?
I think it is likely that certainly as we're facing cost of living crisis, the pressure on wages does mean that there is an incentive, I guess, for people to re-enter the labour market. But what I would say on that specific point about early retirement, that is voluntary early retirement. And I would wager that the likelihood is people in that category have made a decision that they are financially able to do so, not least because they may have experienced saving increases during COVID. I think that it's unlikely that that older age group is likely to re-enter the labour market. Where I think it is more likely, but doesn't speak necessarily directly to the cost of living point, is where students and younger people have made a decision to delay entering the labour market because of instability about what jobs market would be. And I think it is likely that we're going to see a much higher proportion of people in the next 2 to 3 years at that younger age group leaving education and coming back into work.
Yeah, interesting. And Jenny, let's go to the point about wages. We had a conversation, I think it was about November time, maybe October time, about labour shortages. And a leader of a business, a poultry farming business, was with us, and he was really struggling to fill his very seasonal vacancies. And he talked about how really the only weapon in his armory was wage increases, to really strongly incentivize people who perhaps wouldn't typically be the kind of people that he would be able to recruit for that work, to bring them in and help him to deliver what he needed to deliver. Well, first, I suppose the first question is the inflationary pressure on wages going to sustain? And secondly, beyond wages, what else can companies be doing to make sure that they are putting their best foot forward in this, as you say, increasingly competitive market for talent?
Yeah, so maybe on that first point first, I think it is fair to say that we are likely to see a continuation of the tight labour market, not least because I think some of the structural factors that we've just talked about, there's not a likelihood that that is going to change, and probably means that for the next 18 months to 2 years, that will continue. I think the picture on pay is a little bit more complex. It is very likely that there continues to be upward wage pressures. I think it is likely that it might stabilise from the very high rate that it's been currently, partly distorted by the furlough impacts from last year. But tight labour market, upward pressure on wages, very, very likely. And I think the impact of that is twofold. First, the pay pressure is one that is not going to be sustainable for firms unless it is backed up with productivity increases. So I think the first thing to say on what can firms do about this situation and how are organisations that are most effectively going to navigate it, how are they likely to? I think it's first on maximising the productivity of your existing workforce, and that could be through enablers like technology adoption so that you're deploying staff in the areas where you most need it, upskilling and investing in staff so that they are not just upskilled but also more likely to retain, and things like leadership and management investment so that people are staying, you know, people stay at their organization when they're in a great team and when they're with a line manager that is supportive of their health and well-being and supportive of their career development, but also creates an organization which is a nice place to work. So those aspects of existing, maximizing the productivity of your existing staff, I think is one thing for organizations to consider. And the other fundamental one is, what are the reasons why people want to join your organization and people want to stay? Pay is one part. There are lots of different stats online for what staff want from work. What we do know is pay is not the only factor, and it is not the only factor when it comes to why people want to stay in an organization. Other huge impacts are people's ability to work in work arrangements which suit their lifestyle. So, for example, are you considering what notice you're giving to staff around their shift patterns? What compensation are you giving to staff if you cancel those at last minute? Are people able to work core hours and then work flexibly outside? But it might also be that people are staying not just for direct pay, but the wider benefits package too. And that could include things like family-friendly policies, sick pay, and things like that. So I would say that the broader way for organisations to tackle this, to think about everything they can do, it's really, why would an individual want to join the organisation, to stay, and how can you maximise the productivity of your existing staff?
Really interesting. There's a sort of, there's no silver bullet, frustratingly. I wish there was one, Jenny. There's all, that long list is a real sort of package of things that people can do to help. And I think that that's some of the content in the CEO action plan, right, that the CBI has put together to sort of help people just mark their own homework, I guess, in terms of how well they're performing against all these various different levers that they might not be immediately obvious in terms of filling the skill gap. And that's published now on the CBI website, if that's right?
Exactly. And I think links for that will be circulated. I think it's helpful for two things. I mean, one is just having the ideas, the long list almost of ideas for how can you maximize your job attractiveness and the potential of your labor market? How can you adopt tech to maximize your people power? How can you lead and manage to boost productivity, and how can you invest in skills? So it does share ideas for that. But what I also think it is helpful for organizations to determine what their strategy is. As you said, there is no silver bullet, no one size fits all. And that's because all the impacts of the structural effects of your local labor market will be different for firms. What firms have done already and the effectiveness of that will be different. And also what budget and what resources firms have is going to be different. So I think, as well as ideas, what I hope the action plan is helpful for firms is just going through a step-by-step process to determine their response, to understand what the problem is that they're facing, to understand the impact of any actions that they've taken so far, and really assess what their business needs and how they can mobilize all of the different aspects of the team, because it's going to take not just HR directors, it's going to take operational leads, it might take chief technology officers. You know, how do you mobilize the resources of the whole organization to be leaving no stone unturned, frankly, in maximizing why an individual would want to join, stay, and be as productive as possible in your organization?
Thanks so much, Jenny. And there's some good ideas and examples and a great pointer towards, you know, how to sort of innovate in your recruitment processes and reskilling initiatives. And all that good stuff is available in that report. Matthew, I'm going to come back, if I can, to energy, just as we sort of head into the final chunk of the session. Just talk us through, you sort of gave us a bit of a setup at the beginning on energy, and I think we're all really clearly understand as individuals how my gas bill is going to change, because I had a text from my energy supplier yesterday telling me to sort of brace myself. But it's perhaps less obvious how that lands on businesses, and what businesses and the CBI and the government can do to alleviate some of those pressures. Would you just sort of unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Liz. I mean, look, I think similar to labour in a sense, no business is in exactly this, you know, two businesses are in exactly the same kind of situation. I think there is there's a bit of a general sort of cost pressure on all businesses, just because energy tends to feed through your supply chains in some way, shape or form, even if you're in sort of fairly simple, like the CBI is, sort of professional services context and things like that, you know, heat, lighting and buildings and things like that. There's those sort of general costs that it adds to. But I think particularly acutely, if you're in one of the energy intensive sectors, you know, sort of steel, ceramics, those kind of industries, energy obviously makes a quite significant part of your cost base. And there, if it's been rising as it has been, businesses don't have the benefit of a sort of price cap as it applies to consumers, for example. Some of the larger companies have been able to hedge their prices for a bit into the future, but a lot of those are coming off now too as well. And generally, the situation there is because other governments have stepped in with various measures to alleviate those costs in the short term. If you've got significantly higher input costs than your international rivals, clearly that's not a very clever situation from a point of view of winning orders and winning business kind of thing. So I think we view there are things that are within the government's gift to do to help in the short term, particularly for those energy intensive businesses to alleviate some of the costs and the reliefs on those. But look, the common thread through all of this, Liz, has been no silver bullet, and I'm afraid it's true of energy as well. I think this is actually the real solution lies in a sort of more medium to long term play. We should help those most in need in the short term, both on the consumer front and the energy intensive industries, to help get through and try and smooth the pain as best we can. But the long term play, I think, Liz, has to lie in regulatory form to end up with a new market structure. You know, what we've seen play out in the UK is actually we've sort of gone all in on competition without thinking through some of the consequences of that. And my suggestions would be, in terms of regulatory reform, we probably need a higher bar in the future for market access. If you're an energy supplier and wants to play in this, that needs to be a sort of tougher, higher bar. Second, I think there's probably some lessons from the financial sector and the financial crisis, where we now have quite sort of ongoing, pretty stringent stress tests, for example, for different scenarios and things like that. There's probably some lessons we could grab from that and apply to the energy sector in the future of how that's managed. So tougher stress tests. And then the third bit really has to be, I think, you know, we want a big play on about a sort of sustainable market. So continuing to encourage the investment in the green plays and so on, which means it's much more within the UK's gift rather than the sort of at the whim of the global markets and so on. And then a sort of final ingredient would be a sort of no surprises regime, as best we can get it, on prices sort of thing. So those, I think, feel like the component parts of what needs to be quite a significant regulatory reform play to overhaul the structure of the market. And that's kind of what's going to be required in the medium to long term, once we get past these short term pain points as best we can, with hopefully a little bit of support from the government along the way.
Indeed, no, not an insignificant to-do list for somebody on regulatory reform there, Matthew. Richard, I wanted to just come back to you before we finish up in a few minutes' time. We've heard from Jenny about a sort of whole smorgasbord of things that companies can be doing to help alleviate some of the pressure, particularly on labour shortages. I wonder if in your sector you might share with us some of the specific things that your members have been doing to try and, there are some particular challenges that your sector is facing, but in the round, things about inclusion, things about leadership, things about incentives, things about the environment, what sorts of changes have you seen in your sector that might, you know, be useful for people to hear?
Yeah, it's very interesting what Jenny was saying, actually, and I think it's very pertinent to a discussion on supply chain issues, is that labour is right up there with one of the main challenges. I think the issue, ports are often in areas of high deprivation around our coastal regions. They don't necessarily have a number of job applicant shortages, but what they do have, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this, is those people with the direct, you know, relevant experience and skills. They're almost kind of ready to hit the ground running type applicants. So that's a challenge. And what ports have been doing, we're just starting out this journey, really. So we're working with FE colleges across the board, particularly around the larger port gateways, to work with the local colleges to design sort of skills pipeline courses to make sure that logistics and ports and other relevant activities are included, so that young people firstly have an idea that ports exist, because believe it or not, a lot of people don't really know much about ports in the UK. We're a rather sort of forgotten about sector on many levels, handling freight as opposed to, you know, passengers, where a lot of the transport focus is from policymakers, etc. So working with colleges to design schemes to get young people and others interested in a career in ports is something that we're doing at the moment. Us as the association are looking to supplement that by highlighting the different types of roles there are. And I'm sure this is a generic factor. Ports, like others, other industries, are looking at modernizing technology. And for a sector that's very traditional in terms of, you know, our labor footprint and you see a lot of men working in the port sector, we think that getting, you know, innovation, automation, smart technologies is going to be a good way to attract a different type of person, people with different kind of experience, different skills, and a different, you know, kind of diverse range of people, which, you know, we can double up our pool to different types of people. So, yeah, there's a lot going on there. But, you know, the kind of immediate challenge, as Jenny was saying, I think is very much with us for the time being. And we are noticing HR managers and directors at ports, recruitment specialists, finance specialists are noticing that. I think Jenny mentioned the term churn. That's definitely an issue. And whilst we have certain niche topic, you know, niche activities in ports, marine jobs, etc., where there is a bit of a shortage, those more generic roles in administration, finance, HR, marketing, you know, PR, etc., managerial roles, we are seeing that sort of the employee has a kind of a higher expectation of salary, higher expectation of certain, you know, kind of arrangements, whether they're working remotely, etc. So ports, like others, have got to respond to that, have got to compete in this this very sort of national network at the moment. Finally, just when we talk to government about things like trade deals, traditionally we were always talking about sort of nitty-gritty issues like customs controls and border processes. Now I'm seeing a lot more interest in, you know, kind of labor and skills being included in trade deals. For example, India, you know, just started talking with the DIT about a trade deal with India. So we as a sector, the maritime sector, are keen that sort of marine professionals are included within the arrangements there, so we can get particular type of skills from India to come over to the UK.
Thanks ever so much, Richard. It's a right in the thick of it is how I would summarise. I mean, it's a fascinating testbed in many ways, as you say, a traditional industry, short-term pressures, you know, ambitious long-term plan, lots of new technologies that are going to sort of change the frame. I'd love to sort of see you again in 2 years' time and see how things are different. Matthew, before we close, there's a lot of moving parts in all of this, and I'm conscious that people listening and watching might be thinking, oh my good grief, where do I start, what's going to happen? It's not an easy time to be a business leader. And you mentioned a tool that the CBI has been working on that I think, just in terms of getting a sense of shared experience, getting a bit of context, that I think people might find, you know, genuinely helpful. Just to give us a bit of a sense of what that is and how people can get hold of it.
Yeah, thanks, Liz. Look, what we've been working together, and it really draws on the power and the strength of the CBI's network with businesses large, medium and small in all parts of the UK, in loads of different sectors, and in particular our trade association networks. We've been building up what we've called an insights dashboard, essentially, which gives a flavour and a picture of, across all different industry sectors, what are the particular issues and pinch points? Where are they biting? In what kind of time horizon is it now? How long is it likely to run for? Are the potential sort of solutions, and so on? We've got that built up now across all different industry sectors. We've been sharing it with government to enhance their understanding of supply chains and help them think through potential solutions. But it's also now being made available to all CBI members. So again, check out this. And my best guess is most firms will be totally across, of course, their own business and what's going on in their own supply chains. But as we've talked about in this session, you know, so much of this is interconnected. So if by sharing what is going on in sort of adjacent related sectors and right across the economy, it helps people with their own business planning, just to build up a picture of what is going on and adds a little bit of richness and colour to that, then hopefully that will be helpful for people as they go about their forward plans, and they can identify where some of the pinch points and spikes might be and think about how they mitigate those. So that's what we're making available, is I hope people find that helpful. And I guess to close, the ask would be, look, if you're already feeding in insights and information that help us put that together, please do continue to do so. It's genuinely really, really helpful. And if you're not, and you've got further insights and thoughts to share, please do get in touch, because we'd love to add that the more people that are inputting to it, the richer the insights become.
Thanks ever so much, Matthew. Super interesting conversation this morning. I've really enjoyed it. I guess my message to everybody watching or listening is keep on keeping on. CBI is there to help you as much as they possibly can. All that remains for me to say thank you very, very much to Jenny and to Matthew from the CBI and to Richard Ballantyne, Chief Executive of the British Ports Association, for your time. As I always say, whether you're watching or listening, wherever you are, put the kettle on before you go and open your emails, and we'll see you again really soon. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.